Hey guys, I'm Megan.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is Sinners Among Saints. Everybody.
Hello.
Welcome back to another week.
Yes, another week.
Yep.
I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. I don't know what was happening in my mind. Obviously, I don't know.
We'll just leave it at that because I don't know.
I just got my caffeine and I'm like, you know.
Me and Lindsay just got back from my daughter's first solo dance competition,
oh
you guys.
Oh my gosh, it was so good.
And she did so good, and I was so proud of her. And then she won first place.
Yay!
So it was like a good...
And we both cried.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
Neither one of us are criers, and so...
No, but it's, I don't know, something about watching your kid just do something, especially because, like, I danced for, like, 20 years, and I would have never done a solo.
Yeah.
Like, I just never had... I felt very confident on stage, like in group, or I even did duets and I was fine, but like by myself, I would have never done it.
It would be terrifying.
And she did it, and it was outside of her comfort zone, and she did so freaking good.
She did so good.
But like I was telling my therapist about it and how nervous I was for her. And she's like, it's almost like your inner child is like freaking out.
Aww.
And I'm like, it totally is. And so the whole time she was dancing, I like literally was not breathing because I was just like so nervous and I didn't want her to mess up. And she did so good. And as soon as she got done dancing, I just like all of my emotions was like the adrenaline dump or something. And I was just like, oh, it's crying.
It was really cute, actually. Oh. And it looked like she was having a full-blown panic attack because she had to put...
Breathe.
So when one of my kids has a panic attack, we have to, like, make him put his hand on his chest and breathe. And she, like, had her hand on her chest and she's, like, breathing so deep and crying. And I was like,
trying to not, like, have a complete meltdown like a blubbering idiot in the middle of the thing. But I was just I was so proud of her and she did so good. And
she did
just...
so good.
So much... more brave than I would have ever been at that age. And
I hope it gives her even more confidence because it was her first solo and she rocked it and won first place.
Yeah, I think
and there was a part she even forgot like one little part and she just like...
She improv'd it and...
I was going to say ad-libbed and I was like, that's
I mean, same
not
thing,
right
kind of. Yeah, same thing.
Improv'd it and you couldn't even tell.
No, she did so good.
It was so good. She did amazing.
Yeah, and we have team competition tomorrow, so that'll be fun. I always like to watch everybody, but this tonight was extra fun because it was her first time and I was just so proud of her. It was good.
Yay.
Good job, Lily.
That was really cool.
Yeah. Okay, there is a story I wanted to talk about. That was sent to me.
Oh, okay.
From my aunt, Cynthia.
Hi, Cynthia.
It's a murder in Brigham.
Oh.
And they just found the body like a week or two ago.
Oh my gosh.
And it's very, very weird. So I pulled up the article like after she sent it to me, we talked for a minute. The headline for the article says, "No foul play suspected in Brigham City woman's death." So it's been 3 weeks after a woman's body was found in a Brigham City creek. And this says new documents reveal that detectives are looking into her death as a possible homicide.
Okay. Okay.
But remember the first says no foul play. Okay.
So then homicide is definitely foul play.
So then you go on to... This is a 61-year-old Fanny Escalona de Angola. She was found unresponsive in Boxelder Creek. And like one of her neighbors was like, for her to be found the way she did, it just didn't feel right in my heart. All of these things, okay? So let me just read to you in this article that says no foul play. In the affidavit for a search warrant, Corporal Matt Knudsen said she was discovered with a ligature tied in a knot around her neck, Markings under the ligature suggest that it had been wrapped around the neck multiple times and fastened securely, which could possibly have restricted the airway. The woman was discovered in the water without any pants. So what? 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 I don't understand.
Was she doing that thing where you like choke
autoerotic
yourself?
Asphyxiation out in Brigham City Creek?
But she like tied herself to a tree? I don't know what's happening.
I don't either.
How is that not foul play?
I don't know.
When you find a woman with their pants removed.
Yeah.
And a rope around her neck.
I have no idea. I literally read the article like 3 or 4 times because I was like, am I reading something wrong? Like, am I...
Like, in my mind, that's the only other scenario of how that would happen.
Yeah.
That's not foul play.
No. Yeah. I am baffled. So, I think eventually we'll probably do a story on it because number one, like that's our hometown. And number two, like it seems super weird and
that is
whatever.
So weird.
But we were talking because I was like, you know, if, I mean, there's murders all the time in Salt Lake, right? Even if it's like a bigger one, they talk about it on the news, but it's like such a big area, right? So you feel very buffered by the amount of people that are there. Like,
yes.
Like when Mackenzie Lewick went missing.
Yeah.
It was like, I was so scared and I work at the university, like I'm up there, but I never was like afraid that I was going to be murdered or kidnapped or anything, right? Because it just like it's just there's so many people around here. But like in Brigham City, like you're kind of isolated in that, like there's, you know, you have Brigham and then like Tremont and then like Idaho. Like you don't, like it's very, very small. And so to have like a murderer potentially in the midst of like the very few people that are there, I was like, that is terrifying. Like, I would not want my child to be out.
No.
Ever. Like, it's so much more scary in a small town setting.
Well, and how have we not heard about this? Like, how has this not been on the news?
Because there's no foul play.
Okay.
Because it's perfectly normal. Everything's fine. Nobody look.
What is happening in Brigham since we left? Like, if this is a normal occurrence that has no foul play.
If it was the cop that found her, is like, shit. Oh, no. No foul play. Everything's fine, guys.
We're good. It's good.
Look the other way.
It's good. We're all good. Nothing to see here.
Yeah, I have no idea. Okay. So I'm going to keep an eye on that one because I was like, I don't understand. I don't understand.
Yeah.
But she sent me that and I was like, oh, that's super interesting.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. So there's that.
Okay.
We had our big accident yesterday on the freeway. Did you see that too?
Yeah. Well... Wait, was that? Oh, that was yesterday. I couldn't remember if that was yesterday or today.
I know.
I had several patients that were late because
were
of
they?
The accident.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you seen the dash cam footage of it?
No.
Well, it's not of the accident, but it's a dash cam of like this car. So what had happened for people who don't live here, like in Utah, is we had a wrong way driver on the freeway who then hit a bus. It's like a big, like a, not a school bus, but like a big transportation type.
Yes.
It looks like a school bus, but it's like a little bit bigger and longer. It looks like the buses that you see in movies that transport inmates. But this one had military personnel in it. But a truck was going wrong way on the freeway, ended up hitting that bus carrying the military personnel. Everyone on the bus was okay, but the driver of the vehicle going the wrong way died. So
how me and a couple people at work were talking about it. But it's like lately we've been hearing so much about people going the wrong way.
Because there was just south.
And I don't understand what's happening because
it has
where
to be
she
DUI.
Got on.
It has to be.
Was like North Salt Lake, right?
So what I think because she. So or I don't know if it's a he or a she. Was it a girl? It was a person, whoever it was.
I think it was a male.
So they,
I don't know why
the
I said
accident
she. I think
was,
it was a male.
The accident was by 6th North, but they were coming from before that. So at least 4th South was where they would have had to have gotten on the freeway, which is a good half mile or more going the wrong direction. So on the dash cam footage of just some random car, they're driving southbound on I-15 and you see them come up like behind the bus. The bus is like in the fast lane. And they go, and it's early morning, it's like dark outside still. So like this car goes around the bus and gets in front of it and is just driving. And then eventually you see headlights and this person was driving the wrong direction in the shoulder. And they pass that car and then somehow, I mean, it must have hit the bus shortly after that.
It's just weird. There was one crazy. Not too long ago where the police officer, like, ended up getting on going the wrong way as well.
Yeah.
To chase them, and they got in front of them and, like, cut them off.
Yeah.
And they hit the police car.
Yeah.
To try and, like, save everyone else.
Yeah.
Like, but it's been happening a lot lately, and I don't feel like our freeway system is, like, I don't, confusing.
No, and because for as long as that person, you would think if you did accidentally get on the freeway the wrong direction, you would stop.
You'd be like, oh,
you wouldn't
shit.
Drive the wrong way in the freeway because you would, like, logically know that that's very dangerous and would be very frightening for other cars to have some car coming at them. So, I mean, they have to have had a DUI. But it was interesting because a couple of my coworkers come from the north. And so on Thursday, like, they were just talking about how, like, the one had passed it, like, he was like, it had to have just barely happened because, like, the traffic hadn't stopped yet, like, hadn't backed up yet. And so he had, like, a couple pictures of it because he, like, slowly drove past it. But we were talking and I was saying how it had to have been a DUI. And they're like, yeah, but, like, you know, you're, like, driving in the wrong direction for so long. Like, wouldn't you realize? And I was like, listen. So one time my mom was DUI in my vehicle. And she, thankfully, it was winter, and she ended up high centering my car on, like, a snowbank because she was trying to drive on the Ogden River, like, the parkway, whatever. She would have gone into the river had there not been a snowbank, but she swore it used to be a road.
Okay.
She's like, I swear, like, you know, there years ago, there was a road there, and everyone's like, no, there wasn't, and there hasn't been, like, for...
Mother Nature says differently.
Yeah. I'm like, no. But yeah. So I was trying to explain to him that, like, if people have substance abuse issues, you get too much, even if it's just alcohol, not just, you know, not drugs or whatever, like, it really changes all of their, like, cognitive abilities different than Joe Blow, who does not have a substance abuse issue.
It's true.
So
I remember when we lived in Evanston, we were driving to Salt Lake to go to my uncle's funeral, and it was just me and my mom, and she took something right before we left, and so there was construction, and she kept hitting the orange cones, and they were just, like, flying off, and I was just looking at her, and I was like, Mom, like, I was 13, maybe, I was like, Mom, are you okay to drive? Like, what did you take? What's happening?
Yeah.
And she's like, no. Have you not seen? These cones have marks all over them. People do this all the time. There's nothing wrong with me. And I just remember being like, oh, can you please pull over? And she wouldn't. And we ended up getting in a wreck. And she had to go to the hospital. And she had definitely taken things.
Yeah.
And I remember I missed my uncle's funeral because of it.
Oh, yeah.
But she just thought nothing was wrong. She tried to justify it like, look, everyone hits them. That's why they have all these
You're
marks.
Like, no.
Like, no, Mom. That's not everybody hits them.
Okay, so just in this whole line of our moms and craziness, this made me think, and I was about the same age as you, driving. So I had played a softball tournament in Mesquite, and then my mom had a whim and decided we should go to Vegas once the tournament was over because we're so close. So
why not?
So we're driving southern Utah, like, on our way to Las Vegas, and it's just me and her and my little sister. And my mom had to have been coming down off of something. So she kept falling asleep, like, while we were driving. And I kept, like, hitting her, like, you know, Mom, like, wake up. And I remember she just kept getting, like, so mad at me, like, I'm fine. It's like, you're sleeping.
that is definitely not something recommended while, like, driving.
Pretty sure you're supposed to be awake while you're doing this. And don't get mad at me because you're sleeping while you're driving.
Right.
And I remember we stopped at, there's a restaurant, I think it's called the Garden of Eden. Like, Eden.
That sounds so dirty.
Yeah.
Like, ew. Yeah.
But we stopped there
that
to eat,
like,
and
really,
for her,
like,
to, like,
terrible strip club. The Garden
of Eden.
It
was not, at least not that I saw.
Sick.
But yeah, we had to stop there for her to, like, I don't know, pull herself together, take something. I don't know what she did in order to salvage what was happening. But,
oh, memories.
Memories.
Walk down memory lane. Okay, so I heard a joke this week. Well, I read a joke, and I had to tell you because it was, I thought it was really funny and laughed way too hard.
Okay.
So, what did the leper say to the sex worker?
I don't know.
Keep the tip.
whole.
I laughed forever. I laughed forever.
That is great.
There was one more. What does the reception or what did the receptionist say after? Oh, hang on. I got to think how it goes.
Okay. You think for a minute. I was going to tell you guys something too. About my grandma. So do you guys remember, it was like last episode or the one before, we talked about my grandma, like how I'd never seen her like cook, like just where she never ate anything. Remember we kind of talked about that?
Yeah.
So my aunt Cynthia, the same one that sent me this, the other message, had messaged me to say that she was listening to our podcast and was laughing about my comment on my grandma Eliana. And she says, she said, Grandma Eliana was a terrible cook. Her homemade bread was hard as a brick, and she made us eat that because we didn't buy bread from the store until we moved to Salt Lake. And she said, and one time she made us cinnamon rolls and put cayenne pepper inside instead because she didn't notice, and she just saw the C on the spice box. I'm not sure how we survived. So that's apparently where my mom got her cooking skills, was from my grandma, which was pretty much none.
Cayenne pepper.
Yeah. Although my mom could throw together a meal with like literally no food in the house. And that was a gift because I'm not very good at doing that.
Yeah.
I can do like a recipe, but my mom was good at being like, oh, we have like just random things and I'll make a meal out of it. And we survived. She didn't ever try to bake anything though. So.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about this. My grandparents were always like both great cooks. So.
Yeah. That's how grandmas should be.
Okay. What does the receptionist at a sperm bank say as clients leave?
I don't know.
Thanks for coming.
So when I worked at a lab for a little bit, when I was in college, we would have the guys come in and give like sperm samples for generally for vasectomies, you know, to make to double check or whatever.
I do that at my work.
It was always. I don't think I would have been uncomfortable at all, except for they're so uncomfortable when they hand you their paper bag of sperm that it was like, I don't know. It was the weirdest exchange because like they don't want to look at you. They don't really want to talk to you, but you have to ask them questions like, did you collect this within the last, you know, 30 minutes or like whatever? There's like specific questions you have to ask to make sure that the sample is going to be like viable. And they were always so uncomfortable. And then I would get uncomfortable because I'm like, but you're making this weird. Just be normal.
Way to make
questions.
It weird, people.
Yeah. But
yeah, I've had to do that a few times where like post vas, someone will bring in their sperm sample and we have to just make sure that there's nothing dead or alive in it.
Yeah.
And there's been times when like, I remember the first time the doctor who normally does it was gone on vacation. And I was like, what do I do with this? And they bring it in and we had to like, you just have to like suck it up and put it on a slide and look at it under the microscope. And I was like, this just seems really weird.
Yeah, it's, I mean, obviously.
And there were dead sperm in there. So I was like, you need to.
You're still not cleared yet.
Have some more ejaculations.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember when Cody had his vasectomy and he was just telling me, because obviously it was like shortly after we started dating, he got his final, like all clear. But he was saying that, you know, afterwards they tell you you have to ejaculate like, I don't remember how many, like 30 times or whatever.
Yeah.
And he was still married at the time. And he's like, well, that's more than my whole marriage. Like, I don't know if we're ever going to.
This could take a while.
Yeah, I don't know if we're ever going to get like enough of them. But yeah, it's, I mean, obviously I do lab stuff. So I like I love looking at it under the microscope because it's just for me. I'm like, it's so cool. The things you can see in a microscope.
It is pretty cool. I tried to get one of the guys that I work with because he was like worried that he wasn't going to be able to
have kids. Yeah.
And because he had practiced several times and nothing had ever, he had never had any mistakes. Right. So he was like freaked out in his head about it. And I was like, just bring in a sample. I'm sure we can count them and like figure out at least if you're producing sperm.
Yeah. Or if they're
and
like,
I thought nothing about that. And he thought it was like the weirdest thing ever. And I was like, well, in hindsight, maybe that's probably not like something I should have said. But I didn't think of it like that. I was just trying to help you out. Like,
absolutely.
Medically, you know?
Yeah. Let's take a look at it. See if they're all spinning in a circle. They have to be like...
Because then maybe you shouldn't produce.
Well, they have to be
they're all chasing their tails.
Right.
Maybe not.
You might have some in there, but if they're not like good ones.
Yeah.
I remember when I was in college, like that was one of the things we went over was just like, you know, sperm and like all the different kinds and like what they look like and what it meant. And,
yeah.
So one of our assignments was to like draw them all out. Like...
Okay.
All the different kinds. And so I had all these papers around me and I was like drawing them. I was like coloring them and everything. And I remember Shane came home and he's like, what are you doing? Just doodling some sperms. That's it.
Just doing homework.
Yeah. But
yeah.
Anyhow.
All right. Yeah, sorry. I don't know where that tangent came from, but right. You know,
there you are. That's sperm. Us. So we do have one business item, Wendy Sue, up to her Patreon.
Thanks, Wendy Sue.
Yay. So now you'll get all the extra stuff.
The extra.
You'll be super excited.
We are going to record our After Dark episode here pretty soon. Yep. So just in time.
And just keeping on top of things, happy Easter.
Oh, happy Easter. Good job.
Thanks.
Thanks. Such a good job.
I know. I had one memory and I did it. So
yay.
This will be our only holiday this year that we did it right.
You're welcome.
But here you are. So happy Easter. I hope it's good.
Happy Easter. Yes.
And
hope it doesn't snow.
Oh, yeah, that too. So depends on where you are.
Because it's early. I mean, it's the last week of March this year. So yeah. I don't like it when it's in March. I like it when it's in April.
Yeah, I don't know why I always just am like, why does it have to move? Can't we just have it like Christmas where it's just the same like
one? Yeah.
Every year. Because it is.
It has to be on Sunday.
I know, but yeah, I guess so. But yeah, it's always like,
can it be like the third Thanksgiving?
Like where it's like, always.
Yeah, let's do the third Sunday of April.
Yeah. Like just make it one of the Sundays and it's just always
let's
that
Sunday.
Let's
all band together and just celebrate on the third.
Sunday. We can't even get rid of daylight savings here, so we're not going to get Easter changed.
It's true. True.
All right.
Let's do it.
Let's do this. Okay.
I'm ready.
This case that I'm doing this week is pretty interesting. It's not local, but it's Idaho, so close.
Oh, yeah.
Close to
home. Very close.
And it's a little bit different there's a murder, but then there's all sorts of stuff. It's going to focus a lot on some absolutely shit police work. And I hate to say that because I was married to a cop forever. I love police. Like, I'm very pro police.
Yeah, we're pro police.
But I also still know police are humans and not all humans are good people.
True.
And this one was very much a case of like they just decided who they felt it was and they were trying real, real hard to make that stick. So
I hate that's like the worst.
It's terrible.
It is the worst thing that you hear.
Yeah, it's really terrible. But yeah, so let's kind of get into this.
Okay, let's do it.
So Angie Ray Dodge was born December 21st, 1977 in Vancouver, Washington to Jack and Carol Dodge. She was the youngest of four and the only girl, so naturally she was cherished.
Yeah.
Angie started school in San Diego, California, but they soon moved to Idaho Falls, Idaho, where she finished elementary and then went on through high school. She spent most of her high school years helping tutor others in English and math and graduated high school in 1955 is what I was going to say. 20 years before she was born.
Before she was born. Yeah.
1995 with honors. She was known to others as intelligent and bubbly. She truly loved the outdoors and being with her family. Camping was one of her most favorite outdoor activities, and her family said that even if the spot they picked was fairly primitive, Angie always managed to find water and start a water fight.
Oh.
She loved the holiday season with Christmas and her birthday just 4 days apart. Her birthday was always combined with a family Christmas party. And Angie never felt overlooked by this. In fact, she loved sharing her special day with those she loved.
Aw, that's nice. Because I know a lot of people who are born around the holiday, they're like, I hate it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
People always just give me one gift instead of two.
Yeah, yeah. But it seems like she really liked it.
Okay.
One thing she loved to do every year was to make Christmas necklaces out of ribbon and bells and give it to all the guests that would come to the family party.
Oh, that's cute.
And she would always have extra supplies in case more people showed up than they thought, so she could make them a necklace real quick.
Aw.
Cute, huh?
That's really nice.
Yeah. The family party also included a program celebrating the birth of Christ with Angie playing Mary. Angie's friends have fond memories of hanging out and cruising around in her car named The Boat.
The Boat.
With Angie driving one hand on the wheel and one foot out the window.
Same. I used to do this all the time.
I actually did this as well. So.
All the time.
Maybe it's a girl thing. I don't know. Girl in a small town thing. I don't know. Something. She could fit several friends inside her car, and they were all amazed at how far the car would go on little gas.
Which is surprising if it's called The Boat, and you can fit that many people in there.
95,
you would
90.
Think that that's like,
because remember,
real bad on gas.
In 2000, so I think that was the first year I was driving, gas was less than a dollar.
Yeah.
So cheap.
I wish we could go back then.
Right, I know.
At least to gas prices.
Can you imagine? I have a 12-gallon tank, 13, like, if it's super, super empty. Can you imagine filling up for $13?
No. Like, oh, my gosh. As soon as you said that, I was like, wait a second.
I can't even fathom it.
I could fill up my tank for under $20.
Yeah.
Oh,
that would be amazing.
That would be blissful.
So just months prior to Angie's death, she traded in her ever-faithful Oldsmobile boat for a brand-new Chevy. Angie's mom, Carol, recalls the last moment she spent with her daughter just hours before tragedy would strike. On the evening of June 12, 1996, Angie stopped by her mom's house to visit around 9 p.m. She was excited about her new apartment, which she had just moved into about 3 weeks prior, but also talked about the hardships of being an adult and being on her own.
Yeah.
Angie was attending college and had just started working at a local beauty salon. Carol said that she remembered while they were talking, she just reached out and gave Angie a hug, and Angie laid her head on her mom's shoulder. Carol told her that she would always be her baby and how much she loved her. Angie left around 10:20 and returned to her apartment. As she drove out, she blew her mom a kiss and mouthed, "I love you."
Ugh.
Mm. Ugh. It's like so sad, but like,
what
so
a,
sweet.
What
too.
A nice like last interaction for them to have.
Yes, because you always hear about people being like, you know, I wish I would have known, I would have said something, or you know what I mean? This seemed like a very loving, like last interaction, but it's still really terrible.
Mm.
In the early morning hours of July 13th, 18-year-old Angie was apparently sleeping when a man broke into her home. He beat Angie, raped her, and then stabbed her 16 times and slit her throat, almost decapitating her.
Oh my gosh.
She died next to her bed in a pool of her own blood. Her shirt had been ripped off her body in the struggle, and her pants were only on one leg.
Oh.
Her favorite teddy bear lay next to her, covered in blood, used to muffle her screams.
Oh, that's
so
like,
sad.
That right there is like so sad.
So sad, especially when you think about like,
it's probably like your childhood.
Her favorite teddy bear, like teddy still bear. Kind of like innocent.
She's little. Yeah. Like, first apartment, she's 18, just out of high school, like whole life ahead of you.
Yeah. And it's the cutest little, it looks like it's a house that like where she lived maybe on the top part of it, or like a house that had been turned into apartments. It's a super cute little like area that she lived in.
Did she live by herself?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, that's horrific.
It's, and there like there's pictures too like of the crime scene, like of the bear, and it's just so sad. As the morning wore on, Angie did not show up for work, which is out of character for the 18-year-old. When Angie's friends tried calling and couldn't get a hold of her, they decided to go to her apartment to see if maybe she had slept through her alarm. This was when the horrific scene was discovered. Idaho Falls detectives were assigned the case and got to work immediately. They began to question friends, family, neighbors, work associates, and anyone else who might know Angie. Crime scene technicians collected evidence and took pictures. There was blood spatter on the walls, carpet, and bed. There was also a stain on her sweatpants, possibly semen, that was collected and sent to the lab for analysis. The investigators followed every tip, even the ones that seemed a little bizarre, like low-budget filmmaker Michael Usry. Michael lived in New Orleans but had ties somewhat to Idaho Falls. But we'll come back to this.
He lived where?
New Orleans.
Okay.
Nolens.
Nolens.
So as time went on, forensic results came back and were placed into the FBI's CODIS system, but no match was found. Now, Angie was part of a group of kids who hung out at the Snake River. So naturally, police began by bringing some of these kids in for questioning. Specifically, Jeremy Sargis, Russ Baldwin, George Pahis, Christopher Tapp, and Benjamin Hobbs. Now, 6 months after questioning these boys, police got word that one of them had been arrested in Ely, Nevada for a brutal rape where he also cut the young woman with a knife. So this man was Benjamin Hobbs, or child. He's like barely an adult. And due to the similarities of the crimes, as well as being friends with Angie, police went to Nevada to question him again. While officers were questioning Hobbs in Nevada, other investigators began to bring in Hobbs's friends for more questioning as well. This time, the interviews were videotaped. On January 7th, 1997, when a 20-year-old named Christopher Tapp was called in by detectives, he was very confused as to what they wanted to talk about. He denied knowing anything about Angie's murder. Chris was a normal teenager, raised in a good home. He got into a little trouble as a teen, but nothing, like, worth note. Back in Nevada, Hobbs continued to deny murdering Angie, and he asked detectives at one point if Angie had been raped the night she was murdered. And they came back with, I don't know, you tell us. And so you can see this, there's a Dateline episode on this. Okay. And so there's like, I want, like, it shows this interview.
I feel like that's kind of a weird question for your friend to ask.
So they're like, well, I don't know, you tell us. And he's like, I don't know. That's why I'm asking you, because if she was, my DNA will prove right there that I'm innocent.
Oh, okay.
So he's like, listen, so I didn't I do this. Was DNA. She raped? Like, because if she was, like, you can take my DNA, like, I'll prove my innocence right there.
Okay. Okay.
So police take blood samples from both Benjamin Hobbs and Christopher Tapp. The police continued to bring Chris in for questioning 9 times in total with over 100 hours and multiple polygraphs. After an interview on January 10th, Chris's parents retained a lawyer for their son. They retained a lawyer because Chris had confessed.
Oh, no.
Chris confessed to being at the apartment when Ben Hobbs raped and murdered Angie. Police arrested Chris at this point for accessory to murder. And he now, sorry, I have the hiccups. He now sat in custody. Amidst all the interviews and Chris's confession, the DNA results also came back. And the semen found on Angie's sweats were not a match for Ben Hobbs or Christopher Tapp.
Okay.
So what now? Chris is released and the police continue on investigating.
I think it's like always weird because when you hear that people confess, you automatically think, of course they did it. But there is an alarming number of people who make false confessions for various reasons.
Yeah.
Some of it's for attention. Some of it's as they feel pressured by police. Some of it's they're fed the information. Mm-hmm. Some of it is that, I mean, there's just so many reasons that people confess to things that they didn't do.
Yes. So that's what we would think would happen, correct?
Yeah.
But Idaho Falls detectives were sure Chris knew more than he was letting on. So he was not released. And they continued trying to get this to fit.
Okay.
So they still believe that Chris was there in Angie's apartment as well as Hobbs. But now they've decided that there's another man. You know, the one who left the DNA.
Yeah, because it's not Hobbs.
Because it's not either one of them.
Okay.
So now they think there's 3 men that have broken into this apartment and raped and murdered Angie. Or were there, at least. So when police tell Chris what they believed has happened now and that they need the name of the mystery man, Chris points the finger at Jeremy Sargis, one of the kids part of the Snake River group.
Okay.
So on Jeremy's birthday, police wake him up, pull him from bed, handcuff him, and take him to the station. They told him that he was now being arrested for accessory to murder of Angie Dodge. He said this was like the most terrifying day of his life.
I'm sure.
I'm not sure how old he was, but I think he had to have been, you know, 18, 19.
Yeah.
Like, so young.
Can you imagine one of your friends, like, okay, let's say some shit goes down with somebody that we know. and the police are questioning me, and I get so freaked out that I'm like, oh yeah, Megan did it.
Yeah.
And of course they're like, well, okay, perfect. So they come knocking at your door.
No.
And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Like, how did I get brought into this?
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah. It would be awful. Like,
I would be so pissed.
Oh, yeah. And he is. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So still the police want answers, or maybe more accurately, the police believed so much that the murderers were part of this group of friends that it seemed they were hoping to get each one of them to roll on the other.
Okay.
So they continue to look at the River Kids. This time they bring in George Pajis. They told him that they didn't believe a word he was saying and that he was just trying to protect his friends. They also bring in Russ Baldwin. But Baldwin had an airtight alibi. He was in jail after being arrested on a failure to appear for fishing without a license. So he's a rebel without a cause, and he was in jail.
Fishing without a license. Yeah.
So he was taken in for this
mistake,
right? He was taken in for this failure to appear around 7 p.m. on the night when Angie was murdered.
Okay.
And he wasn't released until 5 days after the murder.
Oh, okay. So obviously airtight alibi.
Yet police demand a DNA sample because George could have broken out of jail, murdered Angie, then broken back into jail.
What?
Without anybody ever noticing.
It's the perfect crime. Like, for real, you have an alibi, air quotes, right? Yeah. So, of course, you're just going to break out of jail, go murder and rape a girl.
Yeah.
And then break back into jail. Yeah. And so I mean, that nobody ever suspects
you. And you're in your jail clothes. So what, you get there, you take off all your jail clothes, you do this naked. And then you clean off, you put your jail clothes back on. Then somehow you sneak back into the jail and let none the wiser.
First of all, what does that say about your jail right? That you think it's like so easy to break in and out of? Like, what is happening in Idaho?
I mean, apparently not a lot, because this is like throwing them for a loop.
This is awful.
So once again, he gives his DNA sample, shows that he did not break out of jail to go rape and murder his friend. And so he's essentially cleared of that.
Okay.
Now, while Jeremy sat in jail knowing full well who had put him there, he had one thing going for him that Chris did not. Jeremy had a shark of a lawyer who advised him to tell police that he was invoking his Fifth Amendment rights. And with no other evidence aside from Chris's word, the prosecution was forced to drop the charges against Jeremy after just 2 days in custody.
Okay.
Now, Chris had a lawyer. Remember I said before, his parents retained a lawyer for him. But he honestly, not only were the police shit, but his lawyer was one of the worst lawyers I have ever heard of in existence. Okay. So once he was arrested, they placed him into an interrogation room and they called his lawyer. Prior to his lawyer arriving, officers began a discussion with Chris about what type of information they were looking to get out of him.
A discussion?
Yes.
Okay.
So they're not questioning him like without his lawyer present. They're just having a good old chit chat.
Loophole.
Shooting the shit.
Okay.
So moving forward, while in police custody, Christopher was interviewed several more times, but he was separated from his attorneys. His attorney was placed in another office. I think there's two of them where they could observe questioning on CCTV. And Chris only interacted with them during breaks.
What? Why?
I don't know. And I don't know why the lawyers were like, okay.
Like, sure, that works for us.
Sounds good.
No, sir. I want to be with my client.
And be able to tell my client, like, don't answer that.
And then
stop talking.
Yeah.
Stop saying things. You don't have to answer that. Like, that's the whole point of having your lawyer there while you're questioned.
Yeah.
Is for them to be like, you're not answering that. Like, you don't have to answer that.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna like.
And here's the thing. Here's my one piece of advice. Well, I have two pieces of advice, and I think I've given them before. But just to reiterate, if you are ever called in for a serious crime like this, I don't care if you don't know the victim. I don't care if you had nothing to do with it or if you had an airtight alibi.
Yeah.
Lawyer the fuck up.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
And do not do a lie detector test.
No, and you don't have to answer questions either.
Absolutely, you don't.
I mean, just look at Jeremy. He just said, I'm invoking my Fifth Amendment right.
Yep.
And that was it. And he didn't talk.
And just lawyer up because...
Yeah.
But don't get a dumbass lawyer like this one.
No, he's the worst. I don't even know who his lawyer was. It didn't ever say.
Yeah, people think that makes them look more guilty, and police will tell you.
Yeah.
Like, detectives that are interviewing will be like, well, why do you need a lawyer?
They don't want you to get a lawyer.
Of course they don't want you to get a lawyer, because you're way more likely to say something incriminating.
Oh, yeah.
Even if you had nothing to do with the crime.
Do you ever watch 48 Hours?
Yes.
And every, like... maybe 1.1% of the time does someone lawyer up immediately.
Yeah.
And every time they do, the detectives are like, fuck.
Yeah. Just do it. Just lawyer up.
Because outside of that, they can get a confession. Like, get, you know. And I mean, I don't think
that's literally why they read you your rights.
Yeah.
You have the right to an attorney and have it present during questioning.
Yes. Yes.
So just do it, people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So at one point, because Chris is struggling so hard at correctly drawing out the crime scene, he asks police if they would take him to Angie's apartment.
What?
Police agree, and so do Chris's lawyers, that they could take their client to Angie's apartment, but they were not going to go with. So his lawyers literally like, that's fine, I don't care, but we're not going to
come. You got this, bro. You got it.
So no one knows exactly what happened.
And they're taking him to this house so that he can better describe how he murdered this person?
Yeah, because he's not doing a great job at it.
What?
Okay, so no one knows really what happens at the house because it's not videotaped nor is it recorded. So you don't have audio or video of what even went on there.
No!
Okay. So here's kind of how Chris's... interviews went, like, just in a quick overview of the several interviews he has, right? So at first, Chris denies having any knowledge of the crime, right? You see the videos, you watch it, he's like, I have no idea, like, what? Nothing, no idea.
Okay.
No idea. Then he states that his friend Ben Hobbs was the one who killed Angie, but he had just asked Chris to help with an alibi.
Okay.
Then the story changes to Chris admitting that he had accompanied Hobbs to Angie's home on the night of the murder. Chris stated that Hobbs wanted to confront Angie because he believed that she had convinced his wife to leave him. Chris stated that Angie and Hobbs began to fight and that Hobbs...
Wait. Whose wife?
Hobbs. Benjamin Hobbs.
He's married?
Apparently.
Okay.
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 So they began to fight and Hobbs punches Angie and then stabbed her twice. Chris said at this point he left the apartment, but then later returned and found Angie dead and no one at the apartment.
Okay.
Chris then says, actually, he was there during the murder and that he and Jeremy held Angie's arms down while she was raped.
Okay.
Okay. So the story is ever changing and somehow this did not... alert police. I don't know if it didn't alert them. I think they kind of knew all along. They were just trying so hard. They were so sure for whatever reason in their mind that he had been there.
This reminds me of Making a Murderer.
So
have you seen that?
I have not, but I also I have access to The Daily Wire and Candace Owens did one
with convicting a murder.
It. Yeah, well, it was the same like thing and just proved like showing all the stuff that apparently was
and
wrong.
And I want to watch it now.
I do too. Yeah,
but you have to watch the one.
And I do need to watch it.
I'm watching it again right now because Mario hadn't seen it, so we're watching it together. But they basically like get a false confession out of I think he's 16 at the time he confesses.
Okay,
without a parent present.
I'll have to watch it.
And they go through a whole big thing at the end with like false confessions and
yeah, I'll have to watch it and then maybe we could watch the other one together.
Yeah.
Because I do have access to that. Okay. Anyway. So instead of, you know, I don't know, thinking like, huh, weird, this kid just like, keeps changing his story, like, over and over as to who was there and what had happened. They decide to move forward with what they had. Chris's confession. No DNA evidence to match him or anyone else to the crime. They held a press conference on February 3rd, 1997, where they formally charged Chris with first-degree murder, rape, and the use of a deadly weapon.
Oh, no.
During trial, Chris tried to get his statements thrown out on the grounds that his right to counsel had been violated during police interviews and that the statements were involuntary. And before this motion was decided on, Chris's attorney withdrew himself from the case and he was appointed new lawyers.
Good. He needs some new lawyers.
He does. But I'm guessing, like, it sounds like his parents were paying for a lawyer and now it seems like he has public defenders. But at this point, they're, like, already at trial, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, the damage is already done.
Yeah, and his shit attorney's like, well, I'm just going to wash my hands of this one.
I don't this want case this up. On my record.
Yeah.
I already screwed it up beyond repair.
Yeah. So the court denies his motion to get his statements withdrawn, except for the statements made on January 11th when he was arrested and prior to his attorney arriving. So when they were having those discussions. They threw out all of that.
Okay.
But nothing else. So a jury trial took place. The prosecution's case was almost solely based on Chris's confession, as there was literally no physical evidence that linked him to the crime at all. And somehow through all of this, Chris Tapp was convicted of rape and first-degree murder.
It's because confessions can be so, like, damning. Detrimental.
Yeah, they can
be. You know, like, if you're a jury and you hear someone confess to this. This is what's so hard when people confess for nefarious reasons and then they recant their confession. Mm-hmm. It's already on the record.
I just wonder, like, do they not show them all of the interviews? Like, all of the different changes in testimony? You know what I mean? Like, are in changes of his, like, of what he said? Because I feel like as a juror, at that point, you'd be like, well, he did confess, but he confessed to, like, a lot of different things.
Yeah.
One of them also being that he wasn't there.
Right.
Like, so it's, I don't know. It's so, so scary. Now, at sentencing, the court rejected the state's request for the death penalty. Okay. Can you imagine? I'm just telling you, he is wrongly convicted. And can you imagine how they sent, like, put him to death?
To death? No.
It's not okay.
And he's a baby.
He's so young.
And during all of this, where is the real killer? Like, this is so sad.
Yeah,
that
it really is.
This poor, sweet, innocent girl lost her life, and nothing is being done.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. So they end up giving him a sentence of life plus 15 with a 30-year minimum for the first-degree murder and a concurrent sentence of 20 with a minimum of 10 for the rape. So essentially, he's going in for at least 40 years up to life.
Okay,
30 for the murder, 10 for the rape, then up to life. So now with one man behind bars for Angie's murder, police continue on the search for the other mystery man who was there, the one who matched the DNA. Because they do think Chris was there. They do feel like they have the right man, but they also are like, nobody matches this DNA evidence, so someone else had to be there.
Okay.
So this went on for several years before police were able to use a new form of DNA testing called familial DNA.
Yes. Okay.
So here's where we touch on the accusation of Michael Ussery. Now, he was a filmmaker from New Orleans who had minor ties to Idaho through a ski trip that he had taken here around the same time. But, like, I don't even think it was exactly the same time. It was just, like, around the same time. And he had sisters who attended college.
How did he even, like, get brought into the mix?
This is where you'll see.
Okay.
So police end up obtaining a court order to search Ancestry.com's Y chromosome database. Now, previously, a man named Michael Ussery Sr., Michael Ussery's father, the one in question here, had given a DNA sample to the Sorensen Molecular Genealogy Foundation through the Mormon Church.
Okay.
Later, the Sorensen Molecular Genealogy Foundation, along with its Y chromosome database, were acquired by Ancestry.com.
Okay.
So the Y chromosome gives you paternal lineage genetic data. Now, while the police found several matches, Michael Oostry Sr. had a match of 34 out of 35 alleles, and this usually indicates that it's a close relative within 3 to 4 generations. So his son was the closest match, as well as having visited Idaho.
I'm sorry, hang on. I'm just shocked a little bit right now because he only had one allele that wasn't missing, and that can go back 3 to 4 generations?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Crazy, huh?
I wouldn't consider a third degree relative like a close relative.
No, but...
But 3 generations?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. Okay.
Also, you know, he does films, and they're dark ones. Like one called Murderabilia, which is about the brutal murder of a young woman.
Oh.
So...
It's not looking good for him.
So police from New Orleans, as well as an Idaho Falls agent and one federal agent, show up at Michael's home in December of 2014. At first, for whatever reason, they tell him they want to question him about a hit and run. And she was like, okay, like, I don't know anything about that. Okay. But he quickly realizes it's for much more serious matter. And in the end, they end up taking a saliva sample from Michael. And 33 days later, he's ruled out as a suspect and the case went cold again.
He's ruled out?
Yeah. He was not a match for the DNA, for this like semen sample.
Okay.
Okay, so knowing that there's still at least another man involved in her daughter's murder, Carol Dodge never gave up researching and pushing investigators to keep looking. Her mom is like so cute. She just reminds me of like your... Very stereotypical. I don't even know if they're Mormon, but she just looks like, I don't know, like this older, like Mormon lady. She's so cute, but she is so determined to solve this case. And she said how, like, she would go to the police department every day and she wouldn't even, like, she wouldn't even wait up front for people. She said she would just walk in the back. And the detectives were like, Carol, you have got to stop, like, doing that. And she's like, nope.
Nope, you better just figure out this case then.
Yeah, essentially.
That's, that's the only way you're getting me to stop.
Yeah, you would never look at her and think that, like, she was this way, but she was, like, she was legit.
That's
she
awesome.
Was, yeah. But she'd also said, too, like, she felt like she kind of lost her mind, like, after her daughter died, because it was, like, she was so just engulfed in this, like, trying to figure out what happened. And so, yeah,
it's, I just can't even imagine.
No,
like,
me either.
You hear of parents losing kids for lots of reasons, and you should never, ever, ever have to lose your child. But to have it be in such a brutal manner, like, I just can't imagine as a mom. I just can't. I can't even fathom it.
Yeah, me either.
It's in a locked compartment in my brain that I hope never,
it stays. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she asked for all of the police reports for Angie's murder, and she would read and reread every police report over and over. She said she didn't sleep, and she would wake up in the middle of the night thinking, what am I missing? Like, what do I not see?
So does this Oostry have any other relatives? Because it's obviously someone in his lineage, right?
No, but we'll talk a little bit later because there's something anyway. So in one of the reports, there's a statement that after she read a few times, began to not really make sense to her, especially in the world of DNA. It had to do with pubic hairs that were found on Angie's body. So there was 8 pubic hairs found on her body, which, first off, I'm just going to say, gross.
I literally just took a bite of something and I'm like, ew.
I have had sex with people, right, for several years of my life.
8 pubic hairs in
That's
one
why I'm like, I have never... I feel like 8 pubic hairs is a lot of pubic hairs. And if, even if it was like your spouse in your bed, you would see those pubic hairs somewhere.
Unless she was trying to fight though and like hold them.
Maybe that's what it was. Cause I'm like, gross. What?
I'll bet that's what happened.
Why are his pubes?
She was probably like trying to get him off.
Good. I hope she pulled so many pubic hairs out and it hurts so bad. But anyway, the statement read that the hairs were similar to or same as the victim. Now, this stood out to Carol because she said, well, it's either Angie's or it's not. It can't be similar to or the same.
Right.
It's either It is or it isn't. There's no question. It's DNA, right? So the more she thought about it, the more she,
Unless they weren't pulled out from the root, right?
Yes, technically.
I don't know how that would happen, but.
Yeah. But the more she thought about it, she remembered an article that she had read about an internationally renowned DNA expert who was an Idaho resident named Dr. Greg Hampikian. Now, he is a fruit fly geneticist at Boise State University.
I'm sorry. I didn't know. So a fruit fly geneticist?
Yeah. So I feel like whenever I watch like Forensic Files, there's always someone who is like has a made up job name, like you're a, you know, forensic mud analyst. And it's like, how do I get this job where like these people get to have like I'm a forensic drywall analyst. And like you look at just what drywall of every murder of like it's there's always someone. And I feel like a fruit fly geneticist, like. How many of those are there in the world, really? And why?
Why would you even use that for?
I mean, maybe fruit flies have way more to do with, like, the circle of life than I even realize. But to me, it seems like a
fruit fly geneticist.
Seems like a very, very niche. And at Boise State University, like, is there a whole class on this? Like, I don't even understand. Or is it just genetics?
Can you imagine? What class are you going to? My fruit fly geneticist class.
So weird.
My professor is a fruit fly geneticist.
Internationally renowned.
Like, what?
Yes, because he's the only one.
Where is this research coming in? Yeah. I need to know this. I don't understand.
It's a very, very, so very bizarre. Interesting, like, yeah, I don't even know. Okay. But anyway, his work isn't only in the classroom. So years prior, Hampikian.
Well, because you don't get a lot of fruit flies just hanging around the classroom.
Hampikian had been asked to test some DNA, and he actually got an innocent man freed from a Georgia prison.
Okay.
So with that, Dr. Hampikian found a new calling, and he founded the Idaho Innocence Project.
Well, thank God
that
you got away from testing fruit flies for whatever you were doing and into things that are making a huge difference in people's lives.
I mean, I think he still does both, but... He at least founded this.
A huge impact in people's lives.
Yes.
Like, wow. What a transition.
Right? Yeah.
Okay.
So Carol decided to call Dr. Hampikian to discuss the pubic hair situation. Now, while talking with him, she also found out that his Innocence Project had just taken on the case of Christopher Tapp. Thinking Carol would be upset, Hampikian was surprised when Carol stated that she just wanted to find out exactly what happened to her daughter, no matter who it was or wasn't.
Okay.
So she was like, you know what? I honestly don't really care. I just want to know what happened.
Well, and I feel like if you're really wanting justice, right, mm-hmm. you don't want someone who's innocent to spend their entire life in prison.
No.
That's not justice for anyone because then the person who really did it is walking free.
Yes. Yes. So she read him the report about the pubic hairs, and his response was the exact same as Carol's. He said, well, they're either Angie's or they're not.
Yeah.
So Dr. Hampikian requested that Carol get the hairs, which she did by just going to the police department and being like, hey, do you guys still have these? I would like to get them, you know, independently tested. And they had them and they gave them to her and she got them tested. So the DNA results come back. And along with all the other DNA results, it showed that no one else had been in that apartment except for Angie and whomever jizzed on her pants. So just, so these samples were not Angie's. They were
his,
but no one else's. They didn't match any of the other people who had been tested for DNA. They weren't any of her other friends. This unknown man was it.
So how the hell was it listed as similar or hers?
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Carol's extremely angry at this news because for over a decade, she's believed that Chris had been in the apartment when Angie died. But since there's still no evidence, her next move was to watch all of Chris's taped interviews herself.
Oh, my gosh.
So she got all of the interviews and
it's
she watched
decade?
Them over
Shit.
A decade.
Okay.
Now, while watching these videos, Carol grew more and more frustrated and even stated that there were times where she wanted to punch her fist through the TV. Chris was being interviewed by Detective Furman. He had also been the school resource officer when Chris was in high school, so they knew each other. And he would repeatedly say things to Chris to trust him that they went way back, like try to kind of put him at ease, right?
Okay.
And over, Chris struggled to remember where Angie lived or even what the layout of the apartment was. There's one part of the interview where he's like, she lived on the corner, right? And Detective Furman's like, she lived in the middle of the street. It's like everything he's saying is like, he's trying to put together something for them.
Yeah.
But it's like never true.
Okay.
So at one point, police give him a piece of paper and they tell him to draw out the layout of the apartment. And as he's drawing it out, they're literally coaching him along the way because he cannot correctly map it out.
Okay.
So he'll be like, oh, is the bedroom here? And they're like, no, the bedroom was like right back here. And so then he would like draw it out, right? Now, even after Detective Furman became the city mayor in 2012, he was adamant that Chris and his friends were guilty of Angie's murder. But now, Carol starts campaigning for Chris's release while still trying to find her daughter's actual killer. So she said, like, at first she really, really hated him. But then after, like, looking at all the evidence, reading all the reports, and then watching the taped interview, she's like, there's no way. No way that he was even there. He could not correctly, like, identify hardly anything.
Well, and so many props to her, because how hard is that?
Oh, yeah.
Feeling like, okay, they at least got one of the guys that was there.
Yeah.
Partial, you know, justice has been served.
Yeah.
And then to, like, go to bat for him and be like, actually, he did, like, I don't think he was there. Well, I don't think he did it.
Well, I do know, like, we've seen sometimes where, like, family members have a hard time not just thinking it's whoever the police said because they want justice so bad. Yeah. But I think for her, like, she was very logical in this, and she did want justice so bad, but she wanted it for the right person.
Right.
And she's like, I don't, like, after watching all of these and getting more and more DNA tests back and, like, literally nothing there is connected to him, and then seeing all this other evidence, she's like, there was no way I could believe that he had actually done it, and I wanted whoever did it to be taken to justice. Like, not having this innocent kid sitting in prison for something he didn't do. So it would take years of looking and researching, but in 2016, Carol came across a new development in forensic DNA collection called the MVAC. Now, it had been developed by a man who also lived and worked in Idaho. I don't know what's with Idaho and their, like, apparently wonderful
DNA stuff.
But,
yeah, go Idaho.
This guy's named Dr. Bruce J. Bradley. So Carol was able to call Dr. Bradley at his company and ask for their help. She was told that if there was something they could do to help that wouldn't interfere with an investigation, they would love to help. So he sent Carol a flyer that he normally gave out at forensic conferences that told all about the MVAC, and she told him she would be in touch. The very next day, Idaho Falls Police called the company back after receiving the information from Carol, and they wanted to know more and let them know that they needed help with some clothing from a 1996 homicide. So Carol got this flyer. She took it straight to the police. They were like, oh, this looks legit.
Okay.
So they call and they want some help with this. So the officer was referred to Francine Bardol. She's a senior CSI tech for West Jordan Police Department. So there's a little Utah tie there.
All right.
Who had acquired one of the first MVAC systems and had become a master at using it. Soon Francine had Angie Sweats and the teddy bear found near her body. They figured that if Chris had been in the apartment and he'd been holding her down like he had said, that his DNA has to be somewhere on her clothes, on the teddy bear.
Yeah.
Like, somewhere. Even if he hadn't, like, you know, been the one who, like, murdered or raped her, but he's saying he was there and he held her down. So they get her clothes, they get her teddy bear. And I'm guessing what the MVAC system is like, because I've seen another case or whatever where it's like a vacuum essentially that just sucks up all of the, like, cells and hairs and whatever you can find on clothing.
Okay.
Francine samples both pieces of evidence, thinking that it would produce a sample of Chris Tapp's DNA, but when results come back, it was to that one male, the unknown male, not Chris. So this rocked the Idaho Falls Police Department. And Francine was asked to test the items again, but to be more thorough, like as thorough as she possibly could.
Okay.
Now, Francine is described as caring.
By the way, this I found this site on this MVAC thing. And it says it's like a sterile wet vacuum where they put a solution onto a surface while simultaneously being vacuumed off the surface. It creates a mini hurricane that loosens the DNA material, which is transferred to the collection bottle and later concentrated onto a filter.
Okay.
So I was like, well, that's cool. I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, me either. So Francine is described as caring, meticulous, careful, professional, and thorough. So she understood the assignment and she got to work. She aggressively MVAC'd the pants, and then she removed all the stuffing from the teddy bear so that she could lay the teddy, the teddy skin flat.
Okay.
And then accurately be able to like sample all points of the bear.
Okay.
And collect every possible skin, hair, saliva, or any other cell that she could. Now, the result was a shit ton of DNA, and every last piece of it matched the semen sample. Not one teeny tiny little speck of DNA ever matched Christopher Tapp.
Okay.
So in 2017, Chris made a deal with the DA. The rape charge was vacated, and he was released with time served. But for some reason, the murder charge remained on his record.
What?
So that was like his deal. I don't know. Like I don't know.
It's why. Like
he didn't ask for a new trial.
It's kind of like, okay, I'll take what I can get at this point. Like I don't want
to
gamble. Right.
He's been in prison for 20 years at this point.
Like I don't want to gamble the rest of my life away.
Right. Right.
Can you imagine 20 years?
20 years of his life.
For something you didn't do.
Yeah.
Ugh. Okay.
So now what? Back to square one. 20 years since Angie's tragic murder and not one damn suspect.
Hmm.
So this time police decide to try familial DNA again, but this time they're going to use GEDmatch, which was a public repository for autosomal DNA. And with the help of Parabon Nanolabs, they receive another hit. The results indicate that the murderer has to be a grandson or great-grandson of Clarence and Cleo Ussery. So it's spelled different than the other guy, okay?
Okay.
So I went to pronounce, how to pronounce whatever. The other guy is U-S-R-Y, Ussery.
Ussery.
This couple's last name is spelled U-S-S-E-R-Y, and it's said, is what at least it said on there, was Ussery.
Okay.
But I feel like it's such a weird last name.
Such a weird
last
name. That,
somehow they have to be,
It had to have been, connected. My grandpa didn't like how it was spelled, or people kept screwing it up,
something.
So then they changed it.
Yeah, because it's so bizarre.
Down the line. Like, that's weird.
It's so weird. And I feel like with his dad having so many similar, matching alleles, their genetics have to cross
absolutely
somewhere, because it's just such a weird last name to have two, like, the matches be that.
Yeah. I'm still confused why they didn't think it was, like, another family member of the Ussery guy, because
I don't know. I don't know if they couldn't find someone else, or if they just decided this. I don't know how they thought pretty much anything that they did.
I know. This
whole time around.
Is not adding up.
No.
Okay.
So C.C. Moore, who is a genetic genealogist at Parabon Labs, narrowed the search down to six unknown male relatives of that couple. One man was identified as someone who was living in Idaho in 1996. So police follow the suspect. They retrieve a DNA sample, but the results come back as negative. So still with no match, 3 months later, after a little more investigation, Moore discovers a seventh previously known suspect named Brian Lee Drips. Now, he lived in Idaho Falls in 1996, but was currently living about 300 miles away in Caldwell, Idaho. Investigators spent hours surveilling Brian Drips, waiting for the perfect moment to collect a DNA sample. That day finally came when Drips threw a cigarette out of his car window. They obtained the sample and tested it, and it was a match.
Okay.
Dun, dun, dun.
So not Usri.
Nope.
But this is one of the other people?
This is someone who was a relative of the Usris. Like the
identified...
The okay. couple, yeah, the Clarence and Cleo Usri.
Okay.
This was a seventh.
But it's Drips?
Mm-hmm.
Like D-R-I-P-S?
P-P-S.
P-P-S.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of weird.
Pee-pee.
Because Christopher Tapp and then Brian Drips.
Oh, stop. Was Tapp T-A-P?
P-P.
Or was it T-A-P-P?
P-P.
Stop it.
So serious. Tapp
and Drips.
Drip.
Drips.
Drip. So,
okay,
in May of 2019, Drips was arrested.
Oh, that's pretty recent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very recent. Drips had a small criminal history, a drug possession in 2002, some driving infractions, and a DUI conviction. He was married in 1996 and lived in Idaho Falls, directly across the street from Angie, with his wife, who was expecting their first child.
Across the street.
And he had been questioned, like, after, because they questioned all of our neighbors, but, yeah. like, nothing really stood out.
Okay.
So, that was kind of it. So, Drips's now ex-wife, Nicole, stated that in 1996, while pregnant, she tried to leave Drips due to drug use and violence. She admitted that they were both drug users, but that she was afraid of him, especially when he was using. Nicole said they got back together after the birth of their first child. They moved to California, had two more kids together before moving back to Caldwell, Idaho, where Drips' mother lived. And then they finalized their divorce in 1998. So literally from 1996 to 1998, they end up having three kids. Because she was...
Shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And they went their separate ways. Now, interestingly, Nicole lost custody of the kids when they divorced, and Drips took care of them.
This guy looks like a creeper.
Yeah. But he raised his kids. Like, she didn't have any. She lost custody of them. Ugh. But at the time of Drips' arrest, she hadn't talked to him in 17 years. But she said she was shocked by the news of what he had done. Since, at the time, she was still married to him and had had two more kids with him after the murder. So kind of freaked you out a little bit.
Can you even imagine finding that out later?
No. Like, to know, like,
ew,
you were living in this house and at one point your husband went across the street and raped and murdered.
No, that would make me feel so, so terrible.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, it's just creepy. Okay, so when police took Drips into custody and began questioning him, the big question was why? Why had he raped and killed this innocent 18-year-old who had her whole life ahead of her? Now, Drips admitted that his intention was to break into Angie's apartment, but only to rape her, not murder her.
Okay.
So he was like, well, I was meant to go in, like, rape her, but I didn't know she was dead when I left.
After you stabbed her that many times?
And almost decapitated her.
Yeah. Come on.
He claims that he was drunk and high on cocaine, but a clear-cut motive as to why was never made clear. In June 2021, Drips took a plea deal, meaning that the death penalty was taken off the table, and he was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison. For Angie's family, this was a taste of justice they had been denied for the past 25 years.
Oh my word. 25 years.
During sentencing, Todd and Roger, Angie's brothers, brought a large photo of their sister taken at the crime scene. They unfolded it on the ground so that Judge Tingey could see in detail exactly what Drips had done to their sister. Todd said, he sentenced me to a lifetime of hell, and so far I have served 9,126 days.
Aww.
I know.
Oh my gosh.
Drips had a lot of people come to the sentencing hearing as character witnesses about what a good man he was and that he's not the person portrayed by the prosecution. But Deputy Attorney General Jessica Kuhn stated that Drips had 23 years to come forward and take responsibility for his crimes. But instead, he sat back and watched an innocent man sit in prison for 20 years for something he had done. She said he was not remorseful. He was only sorry that he was caught.
Okay, here's the thing. If I know somebody that is like the best person in the world, and I find out they did something like that, I don't care if it was 20 years ago.
Right?
I'm not going to be a fucking character witness.
No.
And stand there and be like, oh, you should give him leniency because he's not this monster. He's changed. He did that.
Yeah, he is that monster.
A girl's life. He meant to go in and rape her. He raped her, brutally killed her, and almost decapitated her.
And then just peaced out.
And let a 19-year-old, another 19-year-old child, go to prison for 20 years.
Yeah. Yep.
Think about where you guys were between the ages of 19 and 39.
Oh my God. I had a whole ass life.
All of your childbearing years.
Yeah.
That's so much of your life that was just taken from this kid.
Oh yeah. I bought my first house. I graduated college. I had my kids. I got divorced. You know what I mean? Like
so much. This
so
is
much.
Terrible.
Yeah. It's awful. So Drips did apologize to the Dodge family, saying, I'm sorry. I didn't intend for this to happen. I can't imagine what grief I've caused. He said he wished he could have a do-over of that night, and that he could only imagine how angry he would be if the same thing happened to one of his children. I'm sorry. I know you'll never forgive me, but I'm sorry. In addition to his prison sentence, he was ordered to pay $10,000 in fines. Now, where is Chris Tapp?
Yeah, because he is still a convicted murderer.
So Chris was awarded $11.7 million in 2022, only after suing the city and the police department.
Okay, good. I'm glad he finally
did
something.
And he, along with his mother, Vera, were given an apology from Mayor Rebecca Casper with a promise that the city will do better moving forward. Unfortunately, on November 5th, 2023, Chris died in a Nevada hospital after an altercation at a Las Vegas hotel.
Stop.
Yeah. After a couple of weeks of investigation, the Las Vegas Metro Police Department determined Chris's cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head. The suspect is Daniel Rodimer, a former Nevada congressional candidate and professional wrestler. Apparently, Rodimer had his daughter with him at some hotel party in Las Vegas where Chris was also. And one witness overheard Rodimer saying, if you ever talk to my daughter again, I'll fucking kill you. Just after hearing the witness, the witness heard two loud bangs. Police also had text messages from Rodimer's wife to him saying, I watched you nearly murder someone. I had to take your fucking hands off from his neck as he laid there and you ran away and I spent the next 2 hours trying to take care of him. Nobody should have to watch their husband murder somebody. And at this time, I do believe Rodimer is in custody.
My
court
entire body just like drained of blood and I got so many chills because this poor kid.
Yeah.
Like he just got free.
It's so sad because I feel like there's a part of me that was like, man, you were given like almost $12 million. Like, couldn't you have lived a quiet life? Like, why are you going to these hotel parties in Vegas? Like, I was so frustrated because I was like, seriously. But then at the end of the day, you have to like sit and think he went to prison as a child.
As a child.
He may have got out of prison at 40 or 41 or whatever he was exactly when he got out. But he still mentally is going to be that kid who went into prison.
Yeah.
He has not lived a life. He has not been able to grow, to mature, to live life, to pay bills, to own a house, to have a job. Like all the responsibilities that kind of teach you how to be an adult and how to be responsible.
And think how stupid you were.
Oh my God, yeah.
In your 19 and early 20s especially, where you would like, you know, you haven't had alcohol, right? It's legal. So you like kind of go off the rails.
Right.
And now he's a bazillion, like not a bazillionaire, but a millionaire.
Right. Well, and he, I'm sure,
and he
did
still
not
has
come for
the
money.
Mentality of like a 20-year-old boy.
Yeah, and you've missed out on so much. I could see how you're like, I have millions of dollars. Like, I'm going to go to Vegas.
Yeah,
I'm going to gamble. I'm going to do some shit for a little bit.
Live all the things that I didn't get to experience.
Yep. And then he freaking
absolutely
gets beat to death by this
by a
former congressional candidate and professional wrestler.
No.
Who apparently has an anger problem. And maybe you shouldn't be taking your daughter to hotel parties where there's, because there was another article I read where there was cocaine at the party and everyone was aware, like, was told by Rodimer to, like, not give any to his stepdaughter. But apparently, like, maybe Chris had or whatever the scenario was. But it's like,
yeah, don't put your daughter in that position.
How about you don't take your kids to drug parties?
Right.
Even if they're grown-ups, I don't care. Like, no, that's not okay.
That's not okay.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so sad.
So, the real murderer's in prison. They said he has some health issues, I think.
Good.
Drips had a heart attack shortly after getting to prison. He's still alive, but, like, he had a heart attack. And they said that... the 20 years that he was sentenced to, he'll probably die before he gets released in prison, which I hope he does. And
which I feel like he should have got a whole lot more than 20 years.
Can you imagine being Chris Tapp's mom, though? Like, you see your son, like,
no,
go to prison for all these years, and he gets out and you're like so excited, and then he freaking dies.
No,
like, literally less than 2 years after getting released.
No, that's awful.
And one thing that Angie's mom said was that like Jeremy and Russ and George, all the other kids that had been questioned, they were just smarter than Chris. She was like, they just didn't talk. Like, he just kept talking and talking and talking. And had he just been quiet, you know, in that beginning, like, he probably wouldn't have been where he was, you know, and it's unfortunate that, like, he did, I think, probably trust the police, especially with the one officer being his school resource officer. It's small town, you know, he hadn't had, like, a lot of dealings with the police, so I'm sure he trusted them and was trying to be, like, as forthcoming as he could be.
And then he gets a shit lawyer. Who, like, you really trust your lawyer, right? Like, they're supposed to be on your side. They're supposed to help you.
If they're not stopping you and telling
and
you,
like... And you're paying them.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, that's fine. You can go ahead and do that. Go ahead and go to the apartment so you can draw the picture. And we'll just hang back here.
Yeah. Sure.
Pick us up a coffee on the way back. Yeah. Like, what is happening?
Interview my client. We'll go sit in this other room.
No.
Like, this is not
okay on so many levels.
It's so sad. You, like, think of people's course in life, and it's like... Mm-mm. What was that supposed to be for? You know what I mean? Like, you just think about it. Like, why was that his course? Like, to get railroaded, get sent to prison for 20 years, to then get released and then die. Like, what is supposed to be, you know, what are you supposed to learn from all of that?
And I'm sure he didn't do great in prison because he's young.
He was young.
19.
He was so young.
Right? He was 19?
Yeah, and from Idaho.
19. I mean, naive kid who was convicted of rape and murder. Mm-hmm.
And he's not
of
a rapist.
An 18-year-old.
Yeah, and he's not
so
like
you
a
know that that
murderer.
Didn't go over well.
No.
With the other males in prison.
No, well, I'm sure they saw him. They're like, there's no way you raped and murdered a girl. Like, because he's not like a big, tough-looking kid. You know what I mean?
And he's obviously like very... easily manipulated.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
I'm sure he had terrible things happen in prison.
Oh, I'm sure.
In the 20 years he was there.
Yeah.
That's insane. Yep. Oh, that's so sad. I'm so glad that mom, though, was like, I am not settling for this. I'm
just
going to keep doing
her.
It. I think that's an incredible story.
You guys need to watch the Dateline episode on it. Her daughter's so cute. Angie she had like that really short, like it was like a bob, but like the like chin length, you know, 90s, like, and it was blonde, and she's had like super bright
really
smile.
I pulled up some pictures of her, and there was one that I like really had to smile at because it was like, so kids now won't ever know this, but we used to always go get like our pictures taken, and they always had like
glamour
the
shot.
Jacket, like the leather jacket, and you would pose and have like tons of makeup on, and your hair would be all big.
Yep.
She has one of those, and I was like, oh yeah,
that was absolutely
that was so the time.
So if you have Peacock, Dateline is on Peacock, and it's episode or it's season 32, episode 29, okay, called True Confession. And it's all about Angie and Chris. And you can see like the police interviews. You can see her mom. She's so freaking cute.
Okay.
And it's just, it's,
I'm going to have to go watch it.
Such a sad look at our justice system. That,
so sad.
Because I'm always, like we've talked about this before, I think the best of people more than I probably should. And I just like have such faith in the fact that like the police and lawyers and everybody would have my best interest in mind. And to like, and Detective Furman's on there too. You like hear him talk. And I think some of the interviews were obviously, it was like before the ending, right? So it's like still before they've realized that Chris is innocent. But he's just like, nope, like I'm 100% sure that they were part of this murder. It's like, oh yeah, well, how's your 100% now?
Yeah.
Dickwad.
And I hate that like they never get prosecuted for this kind of stuff.
I know.
It's like, yeah. To me, I feel like there should be some prison time for them, because it's
for
like,
sure,
you know, what you're doing is wrong. You know that you're coercing this
when you can see like
it's say things
right. And it's one thing if it's like he said she said, but when you're looking at the video and you're watching them feed him information, show him what to do, like all of that stuff, at some point like there should be some repercussions on your end,
right,
for incorrect police like interrogation or something. I don't know, but
something.
Lots of things were not done right in that case, and
or at least like a fireable offense, like something. You shouldn't get to continue to be a detective,
yeah,
if you're doing those things, because I get how important it is to catch the bad guy,
yep,
right? And you have a kid that's confessing to stuff, it seems like a jackpot, but when you're literally feeding him what to say,
yeah,
he can't draw a picture, so you take him to the apartment,
yeah,
so then he can draw an accurate picture. Like, there's so many things wrong with that.
Yeah. And I still just feel like when you look at the crime scene, it did not look like there had been multiple people in the house. You know, it did not seem, I mean, very rarely are you going to have three men break into a house and just one person be the bad guy.
Yeah.
And the rest of them just hang out and chill out until you're done raping and murdering some girl and then they all leave. Like, that's just not, I don't even think I've ever heard of a case where that's happened. And so to have so much DNA found, you know, around her body, and it never pointed to this kid. I don't care if he confessed. Like, how do you take that? And how, as a jury, do you convict? I don't think I could, even if there was a confession.
No.
I would be like, there's no DNA evidence, and I don't feel comfortable sending this person to prison without there being any physical evidence of it.
Well, and I hope that all of his confessions tapes were shown, but I feel like a lot of times that doesn't happen.
Probably not. Yeah, I don't know how that works, but
that's really sad.
Yeah. Who knows, though, because I have jury duty again on Tuesday. So.
Oh, did you go to the first one?
They pled. And literally, like, an hour later, I got an email that's like, you're wanted for jury duty. So, because I didn't actually get to do, like, the process before, it didn't tick my box. So, Tuesday, I have jury duty selection again. And the trial should be next week, it said, if it goes through. So,
okay.
If I'm part of a jury, I'll let you, if it's something cool, I'll let you know at least the process. Obviously, I can't talk about the case, but the process of just like what you do. I hope that I don't get turned away, but chances are I will. Chances
are. But I hope you don't either, because I want to live vicariously.
I just want to know, like, I want to be part of that, like,
I want to be on a jury together.
Oh my God, that'd be so great.
How can we make that happen?
I'm like thinking,
who do we have to screw in government to make this dream happen?
Man, if D. Smith was still alive, I could have him. I'd be like, next case you do, pick us. That's the only person I knew on the lawyer side of the law that could have maybe pulled some strings. But
oh man, that would be so nice. And we could get sequestered in a hotel room and just share.
Oh my God, I hope so. That'd be so great.
I just like, oh my gosh, that would be so fun.
It would be so fun.
All right, dreams.
Dreams. Goals.
Goals. Hashtag friend goals.
All right. Well, follow us on all of the things. Check out our Patreon. Like we said, we're doing more and more cool stuff on there. Check out our TikTok.
Do you
want to
tell everyone what the Patreon is going to be? Because we're recording it after this.
Oh, yeah.
The case.
The case is going to be on the escape of Alex Betty.
Yeah. So then we're going to be recording our After Dark. So mm-hmm. go sign up for yep. the
go sign
$10
up.
Tier and you get both of those things.
Yeah. Support us. Support the podcast. Yeah. We love all you guys.
And if you can't do that, that's totally fine. Just keep tuning in and tell all your friends, all your family.
Your dog walker.
Spread the word. You know?
Yeah.
That's all we ask.
All right.
All right. And remember to keep listening if you want in on the sin.
Bye, guys.
Bye.